This is George Kistruck, recorded at the Marguerite Bay Reunion at Bowness on Windermere by Chris Eldon Lee on the 6th of November 2009.
George Kistruck, 17th of February 1942, in Bearsden, which is a suburb of Glasgow.
What was your father?
He was a mechanical engineer. He worked for James Howden, who built equipment for the shipbuilding industry mostly, but also for power stations.
And what sort of education did he have? Public school, private school?
Both. I originally went to Kelvinside Academy in Glasgow until I was 13. I then went to Tunbridge School in Kent until I finished school, and then went on to university
to study
engineering and also geography. I went to Cambridge and I did a part one engineering and decided to do a part two in geography for rather discreditable reasons, but they came out well for Antarctica.
Can you remember your first awareness that there was a place called the Antarctic?
Yes, it was during my first year at the first time it really mattered that this is what the Antarctic is was my first year at university when the Bass Roadshow came round, as it did to all the universities. And there was this wonderful film of setting up Fossil Bluff and otters landing on George VI Sound and things. And the realisation dawning that, hey, these are real people. I could be there doing that. They weren't heroes from a bygone age that you just read about in books.
Was this John Smith's film?
Yes, I think it must have been. I mean, it was a long time ago, and I've seen John Smith's film much more recently than that, but it does look very familiar, yes.
So you hadn't read any of the stories as a child? Or?
To say I had read none of them would be putting it too far. I had read some of them, along with a huge, great continuum of other sort of explorers and adventurous type stories, but I hadn't concentrated on Antarctica particularly until then, yes.
Just describe the Bass Roadshow. You saw this film, somebody must have spoken.
Yes, it was Sir Vivian Fuchs himself actually came round on that particular occasion. And I can't remember detail of it, but what I can remember is, as I said before, the sudden realisation, hey, I could do that, and I think I would rather like it. It looks good fun and the sort of thing that I could do. Apart from the film itself, I don't remember very much at all about what else was said at that meeting.
What do you remember about the selection process, the interview and so on?
Well, it was very informal, was one thing I remember about it. I was very comfortable with it. I was surprised to be considered as a potential glaciologist because as an engineer with surveying experience, beyond the engineering surveying, I had assumed that I would naturally be put onto map making down the peninsula, which is where most civil engineers who went to Bass ended up. And I was surprised when Bill Sloman said, well, with your background, you could be a glaciologist. And it was with a little bit of difficulty that I restrained myself from saying, oh, what's a glaciologist then? But I didn't, and that worked. And so I went to Cambridge, where Charles Swithinbank was just recently established as chief of Bass Glaciology. And he and Gordon Robin, director of the Scott Polar Research Institute, interviewed me, and those two guys had both known each other very well on the Norwegian-British-Swedish Antarctic expedition of the 1950s, so they knew what life on an Antarctic remote outpost base was like, and I was surprised that the sorts of things that particularly Charles Swithinbank wanted to know didn't seem to be much about glaciology or surveying or hard sums or anything like that, but much more practical, mechanics-type engineering, and he was interested in the fact that I used to run old motorbikes and managed to keep them going. I'd been on the Cambridge-Spitzbergen expedition at the end of my time in Cambridge, and that had involved me in quite a lot of nasty, tedious, fiddling work, keeping outboard motors going in bad conditions, and also coping with skis on melting glaciers and things like that. So this all seemed to work, and I got offered the job, and I'm very glad that I was.
Was there any sense that they were sussing you out psychologically as well?
I was never aware of that, and that that did puzzle me a bit. I mean, Bill Slaman was legendary in his ability to spot a FID at 200 metres. And the only time I wondered if I might have been psychoanalysed, as it were, was when I had to go for my medical at a hospital in Chelsea somewhere. I had to go and provide sort of samples of this and that and be checked over by a doctor. And that was an unusual medical, I thought, not that I had been medicalised very often, because he asked me to help him do things. You know, you hold this and I'll put this stick in to see if you've got any sugar in your urine and that sort of thing. Usually doctors are very, very sort of protective about that sort of thing and don't want you to get involved. But it was no problem and I was quite happy to get involved and did it all. And I thought afterwards, well, actually, maybe he was just seeing how I reacted to that. And years later, I challenged Bill Slaman on this. He said, no, 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 nothing like that. No, no, absolutely not. Good heavens, no. What an idea. So all I can say is that I was and am completely unaware of any psychological testing that was done. But I've got to say that if there was any, I think it was extraordinarily successful in the community of people who ended up on the BAS basis.
How big a gap was it between being selected and being dispatched south?
In my case, it was about... it was nearly a year, actually, because Charles was certainly very keen to get me signed up with BAS as soon as possible, which, as I recall, was at least 6 months before the first ship would sail that autumn. This was in 1967 that I was applying, and I actually went south in the autumn of 68, and before that, I think I started work for BAS at the Scott Polar Research Institute in the beginning of June, but I had been recruited before that. It was well back into the end of 1967.
Yeah. Was it clear at that point what you would be doing and where you'd be going?
Not to me, it wasn't. I think Charles had the gleam in his eye, but he wouldn't expect to explain that to me in detail, just because, hey, I didn't even know what glaciology was, and he did know that. And that wasn't a problem, because he was going to train me, and so I got lots of stuff to read. It was like actually being postgraduate at a university again, with a director of studies and supervisions and tutorials and things. So I had the run of the library at Spry, and that was terrific, because it didn't have to be technical things I read all the time. There was all these other books about Nansen and Arctic Canada and things like that, and I was getting paid for it. Wow! And I went on a course in Sweden to learn the nuts and bolts of glaciology, you know, drilling holes in ice and using dyes and that sort of thing.
So yeah. By the time you sailed, you were a glaciologist?
Yes. Yes, I was, yes. I was certainly... a reasonably competent apprentice glaciologist, I would suppose, yes.
But you didn't know where you were going? You didn't know you were going to Fossil Bluff?
No, I knew that the intention was that we'd go to Fossil Bluff for my second winter, if provided it could be resupplied in time. And I was expecting that I would spend my first winter at Adelaide Island, so yes, I did know that amount. And I also knew that I had to go to Halley Bay on the way to pick up the glacier kit and senior glaciologist Andy Wager on the way across from Halley Bay to Adelaide Island. Adelaide was going to be the centre of Bass glaciology from then on.
So you went by ship to Halley?
Yes, that was the Pearl of Dan.
And then flew from there?
No, then from Halley the ship turned round, having relieved the base, and came back to the Falkland Islands, where I then got off with all the glacier kit and stuff that had to go on south, and transshipped first of all to the Bransfield, to the Shackleton, who was there at the time, and we just set off from Stanley and were heading south, and all of a sudden Deception Island blew up, and so we were sitting in the Fiddery on the Bransfield wondering why the hell are we going so fast, you know, and the ship was rolling about in a heavy sea and crockery was smashing and all that kind of thing. And it turned out that the captain had got the radio signal from Bass, so get to Deception Island as fast as you can, there's trouble down there. So we did come down to Deception Island and picked up the people who had been sort of bombed out by the volcano. And after that, I transferred to the John Biscoe and went down south to Adelaide on the John Biscoe.
So The captain of the ship didn't tell you why you were being diverted?
No, not to begin with, but things like that very soon come out. You know, I mean, what he did for... Well, diverted, it wasn't exactly a diversion. I mean, the Bransfield was due to head down towards those Antarctic Peninsula bases anyway. Mm. It's just the urgency was greatly increased, and so we noticed in the behaviour of the ship, yeah.
What met your eyes when you arrived at reception?
Well, a lot. It looked very dirty compared with the rest of the Antarctic environment. We had seen superb, clean snowscapes at South Georgia and at Halley Bay, and we called in at Cygnia, and we'd been to other places. So by then, you know, you get to know what Antarctica looks like, the Antarctic islands, and Deception didn't look like that anymore, although I'm sure once it used to, because of all the ash and stuff from the volcano that had been blown out onto it.
Was the eruption still going?
Not really. There was still a bit of steam puffing out from crevices here and there, but we didn't go very close to it. No. But what I also remember very well is the devastation of the Bass area there, how this river of Laha had smashed straight through the middle of the biggest of the huts that were there and gone on to the beach. And there was a tractor, Ferguson tractor, which had been buried up to the top of its bonnet in this stuff. And it was, yeah, certainly a scene of desolation as far as that was concerned. And the remains of the old whaling station there had also been tossed about like matchsticks. And that was impressive.
What were your feelings when you saw that? Were you concerned or frightened or amazed?
Interested, I would say. Yeah, I wasn't particularly concerned, and certainly not frightened. It didn't seem to be frightening at all. Yes, interested, yes, and I was lucky. I was actually allowed to go ashore, which most of the FIDs weren't, but the reason was I was considered to have done a favour to Professor King, who was a passenger on the Perla Dan, from one of the South African universities, I don't know which. He was a glaciologist and geologist. And at Halley Bay, we had actually dug an ice pit, and he had helped do that, and he thought this was great fun. So he was going to be allowed to go ashore to see the remains of this eruption, so he thought I would like to go along as well. And I was remember being knocked up by the King Fid on the ship at the time, at about 7:30 in the morning, quite unreasonable time when on a day when you had nothing to do, saying, "You get up, you're going ashore." I said, "I'm not, why should I?" "Well, because so-and-so says it." "Well, who the hell's he?" And there was Professor King standing outside the door of the cabin hearing all of this. So I quickly shut up and went and enjoyed it. Yeah.
How were the chaps who were coming ashore, coming aboard?
They had recovered by then. I think they had been fairly distressed at the time that they got picked up by the helicopters from the Palato Pardo. But they were picked up and taken to the Chilean ship and then to the Biscay. And then they came on board the Bransfield and went home, I think. I couldn't actually commit to that, yeah.
Well, you describe very eloquently your first encounter with seasoned FIDs as opposed to pristine, brand new FIDs.
Oh, yes.
This would be at Halley Bay.
Yes, at Halley Bay. That was one of the defining experiences of my Antarctic time, definitely. Right. The Perla Dan had come in on quite a nice sunny day with floating sea ice there, fast ice, leading up to the shelf ice in the distance, about a mile and a half away, I suppose, that year. And there were a lot of FIDs there from the base waiting to welcome the ship in. So she moored up, bows on initially to the fast ice, and threw a rope ladder down over the bows. And these creatures swarmed up the ladder and over the bulwarks and down onto the deck and started beetling down towards the fiddery at the stern of the ship. And I looked at them in just absolute amazement. They were filthy. They were ragged, scarecrows, hair all over the place, beards, you know, ragged as anything. And they went straight into the fiddery as if they owned it and demanded fried eggs in huge numbers. Unfortunately, the cook on the Perla Dan knew exactly what was going to happen, and he'd been asking us for help transporting eggs out of the chilled store. So he had great racks of eggs. I should think there must have been, in each rack, there were at least 12 by 15, I think, eggs. And he'd got us to bring about six of these racks out of the cold store. ready to fry up eggs for the Fids when they came. And he just produced a continuous stream of fried eggs out of the galley, and they ate them. God, am I going to be like that in a year's time? But of course I was.
Did it put you off?
No, it didn't. Again, it was a matter of great interest. You know, this is such a new world. You know, I didn't come here to be sort of put off by what I find. This is interesting. You've got to sort of position yourself into it and see how you fit. And yes, I do remember that.
So you made your way down the west side of the peninsula?
Yes, that's right.
To Fossil Bluff. Yeah. Call
anywhere
on the way?
Yeah, we called at Argentine Island. We had been to Deception Island, and we then, from Argentine Island, as it was then called, Faraday, more recently, we then went to Adelaide Island, and then I disembarked. And from Adelaide Island, yes, you then had to fly to Fossil Bluff, so it was a matter of discovering, well, what are we actually going to do? Because by the time I got aboard the John Biscoe, and was getting closer to Adelaide Island, it then became clear that the possibility had been discussed of putting a wintering party into Fossil Bluff that winter, the winter of 1969, the Antarctic winter of 1969. And I thought, well, you know, fine, why not? No problem with that if it can be done. And it looked as if it should be done reasonably comfortably, because we got to Adelaide Island sometime in January, I would think, and the ships were going away in March, so there should have been plenty of time to complete the resupply of Fossil Bluff and get the wintering party in, all properly equipped and ready to go, and that would have been fine. But there were also problems with the air unit that year, that they had had a nasty adventure trying to... Well, it started before that, actually, the previous season. The single aircraft that was flying, Pilatus Porter, had crashed up on the Antarctic Peninsula and had to be abandoned. And so the people who were on board at the time, which was the last half of a sledge party that had been at Fossil Bluff, plus the pilot and an air mech, had some awkward decisions about what they were then going to do. And the choice that they made, obviously in consultation with Bass and Uncle Tom Cobley and all, was to go back to Fossil Bluff and spend the winter there, which they did. And one of the prime tasks of the air unit when they arrived back at Adelaide in 1968 was to get them out again, which they did, and to salvage the engine from the Pilatus Porter up there on the plateau, because that was still valuable, which they did. But during the course of all this flying about, at one stage, they ended up on the wrong side of the Antarctic Peninsula, on the Larsen Ice Shelf, and it was quite a serious logistical operation to actually get them back again, which involved the Navy and Endurance's helicopters and all sorts of things. And so as a result of that, there was a moratorium on flying for quite some time. Well, that was all investigated. And then when flying started again, it was... declared that there had to be a second aircraft serviceable to come to the rescue if necessary. And what then happened was that this second aircraft, which was a single-engine, petrol-driven Otter, it managed to crash near Stonington Island up on a glacier up there, and no hurt to anybody aboard, and they all walked out without too much difficulty. But no second aircraft anymore. So what's going to happen about getting the people who are still in Fossil Bluff for the summer meteorology? They've got to be brought out. Or are they going to spend the winter? Or is the wintering party, as now planned, is that going to go in there? And the result was, in the end, yes, the wintering party is going to go in there. Two geologists, two glaciologists. And the people who are there at the moment, which is a met man and an air mechanic, and I think that was, there must have been somebody else. There were three of them anyway. They were going to come out. And so that would then be the winter established. The twin otter would fly away and we would get on with it.
That sounds like a lot of indecision. Was that sort of typical of the time?
Oh, I don't think it was indecision exactly. It's the fact that circumstances change so quickly that you have to make new decisions. And each decision you make is conditioned by quite a lot of things, any of which can go wrong. And again, Antarctica is like that, and I'm sure it still is. So it looks as if you're dithering and not making up your mind, but actually you are. But you're having to review that decision very quickly because something fundamental has changed. Therefore, your decision may have to as well. And to try to bulldoze it through as if nothing had changed would be very dangerous. Yeah.
What was your first impression of your little red home in the south?
Ah, yes, I had managed to go there on a look-see trip and had actually seen it. And it was, as always, it had a tremendous, comfortable atmosphere. And we were sort of made welcome by the guys who were there at the time. And, we were given tea and they toasted scones and that sort of thing. And I thought, yeah, this is pretty good, actually. You can live comfortably down here as well as doing all this hard, tedious work all the time. And it was a nice, compact layout. You could see everything that you needed there. There was a nice view. I loved the place, actually, yes, and I really wanted to go there and spend two winters. Yeah, I really did, even after the first visit. And at one stage, it didn't look as if I was going to get in there that winter, and that was disappointing. You know, I wanted to go.
Did you have any say about who the other three guys would be?
No. And again, how that decision was made, I don't know either. But I think that the intention was it was to be a glaciology field base, and so other people needed to be there as well. The geology programme was also interested in having people spend the winter there. And somehow the case was made that four scientists, provided they had a reasonable amount of sort of common sense and nous, could manage without specialist mechanical or mountaineering-type support, or radio operator support either for that matter. And it just about was true. I think we were very unlucky with some of the mechanical problems that we had during the first autumn down there.
And, those,
yeah, you? And we got through those all right in the end.
Yeah. So for the record, the other three guys were?
Andy Wager, glaciologist, Mike Elliott, glaciologist, and Mike Elliott is a geologist, and Mike Bell, geologist. Yeah, so Mike Bell was in his first year. Mike Elliott had spent a year at Adelaide the previous year.
And you all got on famously?
Yeah, I think we got on, by and large, astonishingly well, because four people cooped up in a small premises like that, you're bound to grate on each other's nerves a bit, and coming from different sort of interests and backgrounds, there are bound to be times when somebody reacts in a way that somebody else doesn't expect. And I think Andy Wager felt the burden of command lay rather heavily on his shoulders at times, and this showed. But I think the rest of us knew that and did what we could most of the time to accommodate it. I mean, to say that we never had differences of opinion would be ridiculous. Yes, we did. But I think we were lucky that the way we managed to resolve them was always peaceable. We never had sort of angry words exchanged in high voices.
Were there any mental or social tricks you had to employ, or you found to employ that diffuse any bubbling situations?
Well, knee-jerk reaction to that question. I mean, there are two things that come to mind immediately when you say that. One was that just before I had gone down to Antarctica, I'd had a recurring dislocated shoulder and I had it operated on in a London hospital, during which time I was introduced by an Australian nurse to a book called Let's Talk Strine, which was from the Sydney Morning Herald, and it was a sort of how do you talk Australian by the Australians themselves. And I liked this and I'd bought it, and there was a follow-on as well. And then the New Zealanders produced another one called New Zealand and How to Speak It. And I had these three books and I took them down to Fossil Bluff with me. And I taught the others of this strange lingo, and we used to use it, actually. We used to talk in Strine quite a lot from time to time, and that was a good diffuser of things. You could say something in a fake Australian accent and get away with it that you might not have got away with at other times. So that was one good thing. The other thing I was going to say was I was once accused, to my intense irritation, by Andy of talking too much. And I thought, right, I'll show you guys, I don't talk too much. And I made the resolve that for the next 24 hours, I was not going to open a conversation with anybody. I would respond politely and I would do everything else. I would contribute to a conversation but not initiate new directions in it and just see if anybody noticed the difference. And the first point is they didn't. But the second point is it was actually extremely difficult, you know, to do that without giving the impression that you were fed up, grumpy, just about to go off your trolley or whatever. And so sort of bursts of song and belches and things like that were very good for expressing general sort of satisfaction with life without introducing the subject as something of conversation. So things like that, I think everybody found one way or another of overcoming hurdles.
Yeah, like that. Very valuable, thank you.
Yeah.
Were you aware of any privations, or was life actually quite cosy?
Oh, both. You know, we were aware of privations because the last supply flight in only just got off the ground. It was really touch and go as to whether the wintering party would be properly established. On about the last day, when the plane had been waiting for a week to get us in and it had to go back via South America at the end of the season, on the last day the weather just improved enough to get it going, so they dug it out off on the airstrip, and the poor thing, we loaded it all up with all the last load. It was huge. It was at Adelaide. Yeah. And of course, by the time we dug it out, the thing wouldn't move, so we had to try to get it to taxi and lobbing boxes out. So half the stuff that we'd loaded up because we needed it came out. Now, that's where a lot of the Glacio equipment ended up at Adelaide that winter. But in the end, we did get off the ground, and when we arrived at Fossil Bluff, a lot of the sort of luxuries and things that were on the standard ration for FID's bases weren't there, and we had very little booze, for instance. We only had 23 cans of beer and about 9 bottles of spirits to last us the whole year. Well, it sounds quite a lot, but it isn't, you know, for 4 people. And so what we did was we actually rationed it. We said, OK, we'll have 1 tot of spirits a week on Saturday nights. We're on base in the winter. We'll save all the beer for Midwinter's Day and drink the lot at one go. And that's what we did. So, yes, it was privation in a way. But on the other hand, you know, your Saturday night tot became a very valuable sort of social cohesive occasion. Very, very, very nice. The second year, we had plenty of everything, and it wasn't the same. It really was not. You know, there was no shortage of drink if we wanted it, but you've got to be sensible in a place like that and not overindulge. And so you didn't feel the same cohesion in drinking it together.
Should we talk a bit about the work you were doing?
I suppose we'd better.
The glaciology work. No, both sides of the thing are very valuable.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your very kindly composed notes that glaciology was regarded perhaps as a bit of a Cinderella subject.
Well, only because it had been, and that's my opinion, by the way, so I'm happy to be quoted on it, but as my opinion, not that I've read that or it was official anyway. No, it's just because all the glacier work had been done as an offshoot of geology, and to most geologists, ice is not rock, although it does come within the definition, I'm told, and so therefore, you know, the geology department never really took glaciology particularly seriously. But then Charles Swithinbank was appointed, professional, very experienced, eminent geologist. Glaciologist! I'm cracking up. And that changed things. Yeah.
So what did you set about doing?
Yeah. We had 4 main programme areas to work at. And the first, the most important one was that we were within about 2 years of the end of a thing called the International Hydrological Decade, where Britain had been noticeable for not really contributing a great deal to this, certainly glaciologically. And one of the things which the International Hydrological Decade wanted done was to study a whole string of glaciers from the Alaskan Rockies right the way down through South America, through the Andes, and down onto the Antarctic Peninsula as far south as we could go, to do local studies of a glacier there so they could compare what was happening in different latitudes at more or less the same longitude in the world. And so the first thing to do was find a suitable glacier that we could study. So it had to be defined that it had edges all the way around so that snow that fell in it that you measured had definitely fallen there and not somewhere else and flowed in from the outside. And then to measure it, is this getting bigger or smaller? Is it moving? If so, how fast? That sort of thing. Because the feeling was that 90% of the world's fresh water is down there in Antarctica. It's rather important, even in 1970, to know if there's getting to be more or less of it. And that was before global warming had ever been sort of mentioned or thought of to any extent. So that was the first thing, to find a local glacier, survey it carefully, put a load of stakes in and continue to survey those four times a year, for particularly for accumulation or ablation, but also maybe for movement too, over a longer period. So that was the first thing. The second was to study the floating ice shelves around Alexander Island, particularly the one in George VI Sound, but also there were some on the west side of Alexander Island, which if we could get to them, and we didn't know whether we could or not, but if we could, they would be useful to know what's happening to those, how are they deforming. And just a slight aside, it was that sort of thing that made me a good candidate for the glaciologist work that had to be done there, because I knew about three-dimensional stress dynamics as an engineer, and I knew about strain gauges. And so what we were basically doing with these ice shelf measurements was putting in enormous strain gauges on the surface to see in what direction and how much it was deforming. And the great thing about the floating ice shelves is you know what's happening at the bottom. There's water down there. There's no friction stopping them flowing. So the flow that you measure on the surface, you know it's being caused by features which you can observe and go away and examine if you need to. So that was the floating ice shelves, and that involved setting strings of stakes across George VI Sound in five different places. Yeah, several different places anyway, might only have been four different places, and measuring them from time to time, and then trying to get to these other ice shelves to do the same thing on those, just put in strain gauge rosettes there. The next thing was to measure the or make an estimate of the average annual air temperature over the area we were in, and this surprisingly involved drilling holes in the ice rather than sticking thermometers up in the sky, because somebody had found out that a very good rule of thumb is that if you measure the temperature 10 metres down below the surface of an ice of a glacier, what the temperature down there is very close to the annual mean of. So it's a doddle. So instead of having to take all sorts of temperatures different times of year and work out the average, drill down 10 metres, take the temperature there and you've done it, move on somewhere else. And so that way you can get a lot of good information. And the trouble with that was, you know, drilling a 10-metre hole doesn't sound much, but if you've got to do it by hand, you know, think about that a bit, it's actually not quite as easy and takes quite a long time and is hard work. And, of course, the big drill that would do that was one of the things that got thrown off the aeroplane on the last flight out from Adelaide. So we couldn't do any of that in my first year, but we did some in my second, yes.
And there was another
The other element was radio echo sounding of the ice shelves, and this actually matched up with the other two bits of survey that Scott Polar Research Institute had for the last several years, in 1968, been experimenting with pinging radar signals off glaciers and getting a reflection from the top and the bottom. And that worked, and provided you got the radar frequency right, you could get quite a good running trace of the profile of a glacier, both surface and the undersurface of it. And so to match that up with the way the surface was deforming in plan on the map, was important.
Was this good, solid, reliable science, or was it all a bit seat of the pants?
Oh, no, all those things are good, reliable science, and were the foundation of the data stream which BASS now enjoys. They've got a very good continuous sequence of glaciological and geological and all sorts of other information going back to the 1950s. Yes, it's solid science. And although I've made it sound very amateurish, perhaps, because that's the that's the sort of way I tackle it, because after all, I wasn't a professional glaciologist. No, the science that came out of it was and is important, and the study of the local glacier, which we called Spartan Coombe, but I think it's been renamed since then, that was the forerunner of much more detailed studies which came along later, and which do concern climate change and global warming.
Well, it says in your citation, your Fuchs Medal, that you were perhaps unwittingly laying the foundations for that discovery later on. Is that something you would accept?
Yeah, we were very surprised, actually, in some of the things we found about the behaviour
at the time.
At the time, of what we found on George VI Sound ice sheet, which basically is an L shape. It's like a mirror image of an L. The long upright goes northwards, and then the bottom bit pokes out westwards down the bottom of Alexander Island, and there's a huge sort of ice stream coming off the Antarctic continent down there at the corner, the elbow of it, you would think. And so it's obvious, isn't it, that the ice is flowing northwards up one arm and westwards down the other. Well, we were doing our first detailed measurements up about three quarters of the way up the northern arm and put in a measurement scheme. And first of all, we found we were trying to measure a baseline, and we found that just in a few days, one end had moved, damn it, so we had to go and do it again. And that was surprising, and particularly the direction it was moving in was incredible, because it wasn't moving north or south, it was moving actually pretty well due west, straight into the coast of Alexander Island from the Antarctic Peninsula on the mainland, only 20 miles away. And a few glaciers were coming down there, and they're quite big ones, you can see them. But the fact that the ice in the shelf of George VI Sound was actually moving pretty well due west across the sound, and then where was it going? Well, just when it got right to the edge, you could see pressure was building up, and it was at the within the last few hundred metres turning right and heading north and gradually melting away. That was one amazing thing. And secondly was the amount of melting which went on in the summertime. You couldn't travel on the surface because of huge lakes of slush. And they were partly caused by rock dust blowing off the mountains, which are sedimentary at the Alexander Island side, so quite soft, and they crumble away. And the dust blows onto the ice surface, the snow surface. And then when the sun comes out down there, you know, this stuff melts in, and so you get an awful lot of water lying around in the late summer there. And again, we were really quite startled with that. And that's where, as the reference in the citation, that we went to measure the stakes again and then all melted out. That was why, you know, because, you know, they had probably, we'd drilled them in 2 metres. That was the standard depth we drilled the stake. We put in a 4-metre stake, drilled to half its depth. And you know, it just melted. You know, it all turned to slush and the thing blew over in the first bit of wind that came along.
Did you put two and two together at all? Did you come to any conclusions about what was going on and why and where it might lead?
No. Is the simple answer to that. I'm sorry, but we didn't. No, we just thought, cool, that's amazing, isn't it? Well, we'd better drill them a bit deeper next time, and maybe, because we did want to know an amount by which this had happened. And the fact, you know, that you left in the book, you know, 193 centimetres worth of the stake were protruding when last seen. And when you came back, it was lying flat on its side, if you could find it. Well, yeah, OK. So what? Yeah.
So when the papers about global warming were published, was there a special moment in your mind? Did it all fit into place? In other words, were you surprised to read those documents?
Yes, I was. I was very sceptical about it until one day, quite recently, it was only a handful of years ago, I went on a visit to Bass headquarters in Cambridge for one of the Bass Club reunions, and the glaciologists there were talking about the huge long ice core that they'd drilled out of somewhere or other, and where they could actually see from the gas contained in the bubbles in the ice what the air temperature had been up to 500,000 years ago. And they could show quite clearly that what's going on at the moment is definitely a sort of periodic change. It's not unprecedented, but the rate at which it's happening was unprecedented. And so that I then sort of came to the conclusion, yes, OK, there really is something going on. This isn't just a fluctuation of the sort which has been happening many, many times in the past during the history of the Earth.
So you actually were still quite reluctant to tie that research that was being announced in the mid-90s, I think it was, with your experiences back in the late 60s?
Yes, and I've got to say that it was very gratifying to get that citation, but the thing about the foretelling global warming, that's not right, actually. I didn't claim that, and I wouldn't.